First case for argument is United States v. Hull. Ms. Connor?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Carrie Connor, and I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Hull. Mr. Hull's case involves several issues that I've raised in the brief, but I'd like to focus briefly on some of the hearsay issues and then move on to sentencing. First of all, Your Honors, as the brief indicates, one of the serious errors made in this case is that, regarding hearsay, in fact, that though the government was permitted through several witnesses to testify as to information provided by a government informant who actually was the individual alleged to have been involved in the hand-to-hand transactions for which Mr. Hull faced conviction, that informant was never produced. And there are several areas where the hearsay that was admitted became an issue that made Mr. Hull's case fundamentally unfair as it was presented to the jury. First of all, as I indicated, the informant was the sole person that allegedly met with the person identified by the agents as Mr. Hull. Two agents who were involved, one inside of a hotel room, one outside of the hotel room. There was ample time where the informant was not under observation in her activities. And in fact, the informant allegedly met in the car with an individual who the informant identified as Mr. Hull, but it is only the informant who could have testified as to what went on within the car.
But wasn't there other circumstantial evidence that it was in fact Mr. Hull? Didn't his estranged wife, for example, identify him by the nicknames he was using?
Yes, the estranged wife, and actually the government's argument would be that she was not estranged, Your Honor, that and Mr. Hull had actually claimed that they were estranged, and that was an essential issue in the case. However, yes, she did testify, but Ahmad Opong, I believe her name is, could not and did not offer any testimony regarding the hand-to-hand transactions between the informant and the gentleman alleged to be Mr. Hull. So in terms of the circumstantial evidence, Ms. Opong does not help the government's case at all. She could only testify as to her allegations of past knowledge. And again, Ms. Opong's credibility was a serious issue in the case because she had so much to gain by the testimony she provided. The one, and I think it's important to bring this to the court's attention, and the government mentions this, Agent Williams, at one point in his testimony, actually states that, quote, after, and he's talking at page 112, about when he sees the informant actually meet in the car with the individual, he says, quote, and a drug transaction took place.
And that, of course, was his conclusion.
That's
but wasn't there other circumstantial evidence, such as the fact that she was searched before she met with him, you know, provided with the money, came back, had the drugs, didn't have any money. I mean, and that happened with each of the transactions. That's certainly circumstantial evidence to support that conclusion.
Your Honor, I would say certainly that's some evidence. You can't simply ignore it. But the way that the transaction was set up, it's so unlike the case of Beal, which the government cites to, where an individual is under constant supervision. They can see every movement of the informant. In this case, you have an agent inside of a motel room and an agent outside the motel room. And in fact, there is movement. You have a woman who is a known prostitute who gets into a car with a man for a brief period and then leaves that car and goes into the hotel room. We can use our imagination to think of what she could have done or where drugs might have been or where money might have been that entire period of time. And also, since it is the informant who is actually talking to the person allegedly on the phone, she is the one that has the full wherewithal of what arrangements might be made.
But talking about the telephone conversations and the recordings, I have to say I thought the government made an important point when they said since the jury had already heard Mr. Hull speaking, since he represented himself for some period of time, it was quite capable of identifying his voice as the other voice on the tapes, which then gets us to the point of the confidential informant having these conversations. It brings them together in a way, and obviously this is a case where the government's case had to be built up step by step, but that struck me as quite plausible.
Well, it is. I think that is true. But one of the things that I don't think we can miss in this case is as an evidentiary matter, that the government never sought the authentication or identification of the speaker based on Mr. Hull's voice.
But there was no objection either. I mean,
actually, there was. There was an objection. Now, Mr. Hull, who's representing himself, is not always very articulate. But in fact, Mr. Hull did make a statement at one point, I believe it's at 1 RT 124, where he specifically says, "It's not me."
Right, but that and I understand that he made that objection. But that objection really didn't go to the accuracy of the tape, did it? That really went to the identity. You want us to read it, I take it, as a very broad objection.
Well, I think that both issues were not, both foundational issues were not established by the government. The authenticity.
How would you want them established?
Well, there are several ways they could have done it. They could have actually had his wife make a determination of whether or not, you know, say, is this your husband's voice? They could have had the agent who may have spoken to him say, is this the voice? They never did that. They relied solely on the informant's identification, which leads us to the third part of the hearsay that is so prejudicial and so obviously inadmissible under Williams, and that is that though it was in response to a defense question, not a solicited question, not a solicited response, but a response to a defense question, Agent Bookwalter made the jury aware that the informant, who again was not present, had identified Mr. Hull from a lineup. And
the officer had made the recording, hadn't he?
Actually, there was a recording made, but it was clear from the record that the agent could not hear what was going on the other end of the recording. He could only hear the voice of the informant on the record. So it's a very difficult situation, partly because Mr. Hull represented himself and he was not very articulate about his objections. However, when looking at the case of Williams, it's quite clear that the actions of Agent Bookwalter, which in some sense may have been quite purposeful to make the jury aware that the informant had actually identified Mr. Hull, was in fact highly admissible, inadmissible, and highly prejudicial.
Why is it prejudicial, though? I mean, even if there were mistakes made, for example, in authenticating the tapes and creating a proper foundation, which I, like Judge Williams, I'm not sure that's really the same objection as saying the voice that you're listening to isn't the voice of a particular individual. But even if there were mistakes, why, in the light of all of the evidence, is it prejudicial when we have Hull himself identifying himself as C or Cooley, and we've got the wife, and we've got the fact that the sales take place as they do, and we have the half of the conversation from Agent Bookwalter? We've got a fair amount here.
Well, I think it's all highly prejudicial because, in essence, it's the wife that brings this case together for the government. And the wife, I had some very serious credibility issues. Not only had she from the very outset, for example, even when she first cooperated, said he was involved with selling an ounce every 3 weeks of crack cocaine, and by the time we get to sentencing, she's saying 2 to 3 ounces, where, you know, there's a huge gap. But also, she had so much to gain. She originally started out in this case refusing to cooperate, ended up cooperating, and ended up in the same sentence, in the same case, in a conspiracy theory that Mr. Hull received 365 months, only received a time-served sentence. This, I think her testimony was at great risk. Also, because Mr. Hull, the government had admitted the statement from Mr. Hull, he had admitted to a gun being present in the apartment, had denied that he was aware of any drugs being in the apartment, and had specifically said he had not been living with Ms. Opong at the apartment. We also have extensive testimony, even from Ms. Opong, that even when she didn't live with Mr. Hull, she was involved in distributing drugs.
Right. I mean, the jury did have a fair amount before it, showing that she wasn't exactly a saint. I'm wondering, though, if the implication of your argument about the hearsay point is that the government really just can't bring these prosecutions unless it's willing to call the confidential informant.
Well, I think that is true in a case like this where it's the confidential informant. And remember, we not only have the case at the hotel, but we have three incidents, if you include the one that formed the basis of Ms. Opong's plea of guilty. Three incidents where she goes to an apartment building, the informant, to buy drugs. the agents cannot see who sells her drugs.
But that happens all the time. I mean, people wear wires, or they, you know, they go in, and as Judge Williams said, they're searched before and after. You know, it seems to me the government, on occasion, this may not be such a case, and there may be no record on this, but on occasion, for safety reasons or others, will not want to call a CI.
Well, I think that may be true in some cases, and under, you know, the rules of evidence, there's a basis for showing the unavailability of a witness. The government did not do that in this case. They simply did not produce her. If I may, I'd like to turn especially to the Apprendi issue, which we've raised in this case. And I do think that the hearsay problem does flow even into Apprendi, but I think it's extremely important to talk about today. Because what happened in this case is on several occasions, defense counsel actually submitted and proposed instructions that would have required an instruction to the jury as required by Apprendi that, in fact, the jury had to find beyond a reasonable doubt as to the quantity and nature of the drugs. I don't really want to waste time as to the nature of the drugs because there really was not a dispute that we're talking about crack cocaine in this case. But as to the quantity, there are so many ways in which mathematically the jury could have come up with a determination as to the amount of drugs involved for purposes of trial that since the jury was not instructed, that it was required to find beyond a reasonable doubt that a certain amount of drugs were involved.
But wait a minute. I mean, the jury gets the form that tells them to check either more than 5 grams or 5 grams or less. And I agree, there is no specific instruction that ties that question to the reasonable doubt standard, but the government argues that the jury was told throughout that the reasonable doubt standard applied to everything. So perhaps it would be better practice, perhaps it was even error not to give the reasonable doubt standard, but isn't it harmless error under these circumstances on this record? How could any jury find that he was dealing with only 5 grams.
Well, Your Honor, my white light's on here. I do want to address that quickly because I think it's very important. Because there's a serious division factually between the evidence presented that was based on what the informant had to say and based on what Ms. O'Pong had to say, it was highly relevant. Mathematically, there were a lot of small transactions.
I don't understand your argument. The jury form doesn't refer to reasonable doubt at all.
Absolutely, that's the
yes. Issue. But you're not arguing that therefore Hull wasn't found guilty of possession beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, the argument is.
How do you separate? I mean, your argument seems to be that the term reasonable doubt has to appear in the form.
No, that could be done. The form itself does not fulfill the obligations required.
Yes, I know. That's what you're saying. But it can't be. That would invalidate every criminal judgment in history because the form never talks about reasonable doubt.
I think that the focus need not be on the form, Your Honor. The form is something that...
You said the form was no good.
The form was not enough. I didn't say the form was no good. The form is not enough. It must be accompanied, just like any jury verdict. It must be accompanied by an instruction that, in fact, the finding, the what do you think, is there more than 5 grams or less than 5 grams, must be accompanied by an instruction that finding must be made beyond a reasonable doubt. That instruction was not given. And, in fact, the government actually sought deletion of language from the instructions that might have given the jury that impression. So the issue is not whether or not the special instruction, I'm sorry, it was not whether or not the form itself was a problem as much as the form was not enough. It required, and Apprendi requires, that the instruction be given to the jury.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Carr. Mr. Bella?
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Cooley, the trial counsel in this case, has since transferred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida just in time for winter. And Mr. Baker, the attorney who prepared the government's brief in this case yesterday afternoon, was admitted to the hospital, so I'll be arguing the case for the government today. I had, in fact, coincidentally discussed the case with Mr. Baker during the preparation of the brief in this case, so I'm not unfamiliar with the background of the case. Turning first to the hearsay question, with regards to the two...
Why did the informant not testify?
Unfortunately, that I cannot answer, Your Honor. I am not familiar enough with the case to know the reason why that happened.
Don't you think, though, if there is an unavailability problem, that the government has some obligation to make a record on that? Because you're certainly relying on this CI for some crucial parts of the case, and it does, you know, show up on the record pretty obviously that you don't have this central player testifying before the jury.
As I think the court noted during appellant's argument, there are several reasons why the government may not want to call the CI in a case.
Right, but none of those reasons may apply here.
I think, Your Honor, that it's the government's burden to choose how they intend to prove their case, how they intend to present the case.
But they can't choose to present it by means of hearsay if there are available witnesses.
No, but I think the decision they have to make is, do we have enough admissible evidence, non-hearsay evidence, do we have enough admissible evidence without the testimony of this informant to prove the case to this jury? And I think in this case, given the record, the government could make the decision that, yes, there is enough circumstantial evidence and enough evidence in terms of the observations of the surveillance agents that it's not necessary to call the confidential informant in this case.
How do we know that Hull was the person that the CI was meeting with, that it wasn't his cousin or somebody?
Well, in the case of the purchases at the motel, the agents were there to maintain surveillance and see the defendant arrive in the defendant's vehicle. In the case of the purchases, so I think those purchases are the easiest ones here. In the case of the purchases at the apartment, we have the circumstances where the wife's testimony says that that's how the defendant operated in terms of selling the drugs from the apartment. She described how he operated from the apartment. We have the informant shouting C.
But we can't take that for the truth of it, right?
No. But the agent, I think, can testify that that's what she did, that she shouted C or Cooley, and that somebody from the apartment responded in some fashion by engaging the drug deal with the informant. We have evidence in the record that C or Cooley applied to this defendant, in that the defendant responded positively to that moniker during phone conversations, and we have the wife testifying that those were the nicknames that the defendant used. And so we have all these circumstances showing that the defendant goes by the name C or Cooley. We have the testimony of the manner in which the defendant operated from the apartment, and we have the agent observing the transaction in the apartment, at least to the extent to illustrate that everything that took place in the apartment took place the way the wife says the defendant operated from the apartment, and the name C or Cooley was used at the apartment. So those are all circumstances.
But she would have responded to that also. So he may never have been in the apartment, for all we know.
Well, in any case, the defendant may have had others, minions, if you will, working for the defendant, in which case I think the defendant would be just as responsible for that drug transaction.
Wouldn't you need to show that linkage, though, that these people were, in fact, whoever they were, working for him?
Yes, you would. We have the conspiracy count, which is the first count of the indictment, and we have the wife's testimony that the transactions that took place at the apartment were under the supervision, if you will, of the defendant. That's my understanding of the testimony. So I think we do have that connection with the totality of the evidence in the case. They're showing the conspiracy and the wife's testimony that the defendant operated like that from the apartment. Whether it's the defendant transporting the drugs down on the string, or the wife doing that, or a worker for the defendant. I think we have testimony that that was the defendant's manner of operation, and that was the place from which he dealt drugs.
Moving to these tape-recorded conversations, how do we know the tapes were accurate? There was no testimony that the government introduced on that point.
Well, there was the tapes, there were tape recordings of a conversation which took place in the presence of the agent.
Right, but the agent didn't say, for example, I've listened to the tape, and for what the part of the conversation I heard is accurately recorded on the tape. It was accurate. The agent didn't testify to that.
I think this is a situation where rather than having a party to the conversation, to the entire conversation, testify to the content of the case of the tape, it's rather a situation where we have at least the agent listening to one side of the tape of the conversation, and we have a situation where the equipment was presumably functioning properly.
So the answer to the question is no, you didn't. I mean, the agent didn't testify that he listened to the tape and the tape was accurate as to what he heard. He didn't do that, right?
Again, Your Honor,
yeah,
I apologize.
There was no direct testimony to that fact. I mean, he testified to how the tape was run and when it started and when it ended, but there was no one that really put in evidence that it was accurate.
Again, I apologize that I'm not familiar enough to address the agent's testimony as to his half the conversation. Normally,
is there some standard way in which tapes are authenticated?
Well, I think there's two ways they can be authenticated. One is by a party to the conversation testifying, I've listened to the tape and this accurately reflects the conversation that we engaged in. The second way, however, I think is somebody testifying that the equipment was working properly and accurately recorded the conversation in terms of the equipment working properly. When it works properly, it will record the conversation accurately. There's no indication that the equipment in this case did not work properly.
But was the tape played to the jury?
I believe so.
So they could hear. Now, the defendant didn't testify, did he?
Well, the defendant, in terms of voice identification, Your Honor, the defendant, in representing himself, made opening statements, made statements to the jury, made arguments, made objections, and so the jury had ample opportunity to hear the defendant's voice. That makes this case unique as compared to other cases. It may be a fortuitous circumstance, but in this case, that's what happened. The defendant chose to represent himself, and the jury had ample opportunity to hear his voice because of that.
And maybe I missed it, but did the agent testify in terms of the tape that, you know, the tape was working properly?
Again, I apologize. I can't. I'm not familiar enough to address that.
I thought the record was actually, I mean, obviously we can check this, but it was my impression the record was quite empty of any of the usual authentication things or chain of custody. This, yes, the machine was working properly, or yes, this is what I listened to, or, you know, we took the tapes and stored them in the police, you know, in the storage place. It seemed to me to be a very slipshod operation with this tape, and that if you can bail out of it at all, it's based on the inadequate nature of Mr. Hull's objection. Because if the only thing he objected to was whether it was his voice or not, as you've pointed out, the jury could hear what his voice sounded like, and they could make that decision. But I'm very concerned about virtually everything else about these tapes.
Well, there are several circumstances with regard to the tapes, Your Honor. One is that the defendant, well, the inadequate nature of the objection, but also the defendant did speak extensively in front of the jury by virtue of having represented himself. So the jury was familiar with his voice and could make their own determination.
Well, you're really saying this tape was self-authenticating because they listened to the tape and they listened to him. And
yes.
What alternative hypothesis is there?
Well, there are a couple other things I haven't addressed yet that make it self-authenticating, and that is that the agent could testify it to the phone number that was called, and that is the defendant's phone number. And in fact, there was a telephone bill found in the apartment showing that phone number to be the defendant's phone number, and the wife's testimony that that was the phone that the defendant used.
Yeah, see, that all goes to me to the identity issue. I mean, I think that's plenty of evidence on identity. I don't think that necessarily addresses the...
Another way in which the tape itself authenticating is that the conversation on the tape is between the informant and the defendant says, we're going to meet at a certain place to conduct a drug transaction, for instance, the motel, and then, lo and behold, the defendant shows up in his vehicle at that place just as agreed to on the tape. So that's another.
Is the defendant arguing that the tape was altered and that so that it was fabricated?
I don't see that argument anywhere in the defendant's brief. And I don't see any further.
Any comment on the Apprendi, on the instruction regarding reasonable doubt?
I don't see how there was an Apprendi violation here. The jury was instructed that the determination they make in the case.
Well, Ms. Connor said that the government asked the judge to delete from the instruction something that would have made clear that they had to find quantity beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, the jury is instructed as a whole that they need to make their determination of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The instruction form, the charge, alleges possession of over 5 grams of crack cocaine, and the verdict form clearly asks the jury to determine whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. And if they choose the guilty form, it requires them to choose between more than 5 grams of crack cocaine in quantity or less than 5 grams. To me, that was a very good way to handle the Apprendi issue.
Well, certainly it would have been more thorough and more complete if it was included in the instruction. As I understand it, the government objected to that being included. Why object?
I cannot comment on the thought processes of a government attorney at that point in time. I can hypothesize, I suppose, that it's generally not a good idea to highlight any instruction any more than any other instruction. If the jury has been told to make their determination beyond a reasonable doubt, why then select one certain portion, small portion of the instructions, and further highlight that as though that's something special, where there's a special reason to exercise increased caution with regard to that, as opposed to any other determination they make in the case. I think generally.
I thought that the concern, though, was that they were told find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, of course, which is the first paragraph of that instruction, but that language was missing in the instructions to the effect of everything we're asking you to find has to be found beyond a reasonable doubt, or something that would signal to the jury. I can understand you're picking out, you know, line by line might be a silly thing to do, but I think the concern is that the jury might have been left with the impression that these quantity findings were somehow subsidiary or not still under the reasonable doubt umbrella.
I think if we look at the instructions as a whole, the jury is instructed to make the determination of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The charge alleges over 5 grams of crack cocaine. The jury is instructed that in order to find a person guilty of distribution of cocaine, for example, they have to find these elements, and then the verdict form showing guilty or not guilty, and if guilty, the determination of the quantity. I think as a whole, it satisfies the requirement the jury make the determination beyond a reasonable doubt.
I want to address the obstruction argument, which counsel didn't get a chance to deal with, and I don't have any real problem with him the basis dealing with instructing the wife to say that the drugs belong to her. But the forfeiture claim, saying that he asked the wife to file the false claim, the evidence in the PSI or all was suggested was that he was aware that she was going to do that.
I think that we have to look at the two issues together, that there was an overriding, an overall agreement between the husband and the wife for her to take more responsibility so that he would suffer less punishment. And I think that the her doing so in the forfeiture case should be evaluated in light of the other part of the of that issue of her taking responsibility. And as court indicated, there's no problem with the other part of it, where she claims all the drugs in the apartment are hers. I think that the forfeiture case should also be evaluated in light of that agreement between her and him for her to take more responsibility for the drugs.
So if we find that one was proper and one was improper, should we remand it?
No, I guess what I'm suggesting is that if standing alone, the forfeiture issue would not have been enough to carry the day. I think together with the evidence that she claimed all the drugs in the apartment as hers, together they're enough to carry the day. And perhaps even without the forfeiture issue, the other one is enough to carry the day. So even if we were to not pay attention to the forfeiture testimony, I think the rest of the circumstances, that is her claiming all the drugs in the apartment are hers. She had the conversation with the defendant at MCC. They agreed that they were concerned about his criminal history. They agreed that if she took responsibility, he would suffer less punishment, and then that's what she did, both claiming.
I thought there was something about his criminal history was only one.
That's what I thought, too.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. But whatever it was, and whether they were right or wrong, it was something he was concerned about, and that generated this agreement between them that showed their obstruction of justice.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bella. Mr. Connor?
I apologize to the courts for not being more familiar with
you. We understand.
Thank you.
Give our regards to Mr. Baker. We hope he recovers quickly.
As to the obstruction issue, I'd just like to briefly state that in the record, factually, there is no evidence to indicate that there was an agreement for her to do anything that he instructed her to do. The only point in the record is that she claimed to have informed him that she was or had filed a forfeiture claim. At the time that was going on, as the record reveals, Mr. Hull was being evaluated for competency. And I think that alone should undercut any finding that he actually was a participant in her activities.
Let me ask you a question about the tape. What exactly is your complaint about the tape? Is that it's not his voice on it? Is that your argument? Or do you think that the tape was somehow altered to make him, make admissions?
I have not argued, nor do I believe that there was any evidence specific in the record that the tape had in any way been altered. However, what I am arguing is that it's the government's burden in seeking the introduction of evidence.
Well, I know it's irrelevant. Your only concern is that it might not be his voice. Is that right?
Well, I think my concern is twofold. That first, authentication and identification, they're both elements of the foundation. I'm unaware, I see my time is running up.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm unaware of any allegations of fabrication, but as pointed out by the court, we have no testimony as to chain of evidence
whatsoever. What difference does it make? I mean, if there was a fabrication, he would know it, and that would be an argument. If he's not arguing it, then why does the lack of a foundation or failure to comply with the rules of evidence make any difference?
Because, Your Honor, I don't think it requires the government to purposefully do something wrong in order for...
No, we don't reverse convictions in order to sanction the government for, violating rules. You have to show a prejudicial error of some sort.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that what we have shown is that we have numerous times in which the government has not fulfilled...
No, the only problem you have with the tape, as I understand it, is you think it's not his voice on the tape.
That certainly is one of the arguments.
What's the other concern about the tape?
Well, there could, for example, the tape could have recorded part of the conversation and not the entire conversation.
Oh, yes, but then he would know that, wouldn't he? So he would argue that.
Not if it's not him. He would not know whether or not the entirety of the tape was on there.
Well, anyways, you can't have it both ways. But you can't have it that it's someone else's voice and it's been altered. And if it's someone else, I don't understand. You think it's someone else's voice and that someone else is innocent and he was framed by alterations in the tape also?
No, Your Honor. Nowhere in my brief do we argue alteration. But alteration.
To get alteration.
All
so
right.
The only question is identity. Is that correct?
I think identity is the main issue.
Well, what's the other issue? First you say you haven't argued fabrication. So then it leads me to think the only issue is identity. Now, is there something else that there might be prejudicial about this tape, even if it wasn't altered? I don't get it.
Well, I do think that as a matter of course, the tape is highly prejudicial, because if you look at the transcript of the tape and what was played for the jury, it is the informant who is using the word "see" or "Cooley." The only time "see" or "Cooley" comes up is when in one telephone conversation, when the phone is not answered, the message machine says, "This is Cooley, leave a message." So I do think it's highly prejudicial, and it's particularly prejudicial.
That's a separate question. It's only prejudicial, as I understand it, if it's not his voice on the tape.
Well, certainly. If it's not his voice, so it doesn't matter what they just said.
You think it might be someone else.
According to the
someone
record, he actually declared, that's not my voice.
So someone else is named Cooley, is that it?
Well, the informant is the person identified.
No, but on the tape, is the word Cooley used?
Only in one telephone conversation where it's a telephone
message. It's a conversation, right?
Only the informant uses the
yes,
term.
I understand, but if the voice is not Hull's voice, then there's someone else named Cooley, the person on the tape, right?
Or C. And I do think, Your Honor,
the officer testified that he saw or heard the informant use the word Cooley of Hull.
I believe what he said is C. That C was yelled, but we also have to remember, Your Honor, that
your theory is to the message that this is not Hull's voice on the tape really suggests there are two Cooleys, doesn't there, or two C's?
Well, it suggests that the informant may have used that phrase, and it may not necessarily be the individual, Mr. Hull, who is now before the court on these convictions. If I could just add, one of the reasons it's very important is because on March 23rd, when the informant goes to buy drugs at the house and yells, C.C. Cooley, Amma Opong has admitted that she's the person that comes to the window and sells drugs. Other than
she's Cooley? But
she may be, I don't know.
But surely the voice, you now have three Cooleys.
Well, we may have more than one person
involved.
The voice
on the tape is a male voice, isn't it?
The voice on the tape is a male voice.
You've injected three Cooleys.
Could be. I don't know how many Cooleys there are or how many C's there are. But
more than three?
Well, we know that at least two people have responded to that phrase.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Conner. You were appointed, so we were you not.
I was a point.
Well, we thank you for your very vigorous efforts on behalf of this.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next.